Very good evening to you all, and it's lovely to see you all on such a balmy evening tonight, and welcome you to our Bible class here at Hyde Park. Also, welcome to all those who are joining us online and over the telephone in the first of that our brother Kieran Wilson is giving us on the kingdom prophecies in the book of Micah. And his next installment, I think, is in a fortnight's time, true to say. To introduce Brother Kieran's kind of work for this evening, he's asked us to take a reading from the prophecy of Micah. And we're going to be reading chapter 3 into chapter 4 until verse 5. So we look forward then to Brother Kieran's first installment. And you can see the title. It's Micah's Kingdom Prophecies, and it's entitled The Mountain of the Lord.
Thanks for that, Ralph, and good evening, everyone. I wasn't expecting a full hall, but thank you all for coming out, venturing out. So as Ralph mentioned, it's the first of two talks that I'm going to be doing on Micah, and we'll look primarily at the chapter and a half that we read this morning. Read this evening. You might be a little bit curious as to why I started with chapter 3. We'll get there. We'll make some understanding as to why I wanted to start there. So I can't speak for anyone else, I can speak for myself. I haven't looked a lot at Micah prior to doing this study. It hasn't been a book that sort of had jumped down and I'd gone, hey, I want to look at Micah. And similarly, I guess with some of the other minor prophets. Sure, we know some of the verses that are in there, so Micah 4 verse 2, and I guess that little section we're quite familiar with. We'll be familiar with Micah 5, verse 2, that we'll look at in a fortnight's time. It speaks about the birth of Jesus. Maybe Micah chapter 7 talks about the amazing forgiveness we have. But outside of that, I couldn't pick up too much more. Just a cursory look from what I'd looked at before. But diving into this book, this is an absolutely amazing book. We're going to look at some great stuff, and primarily next week as well, or next fortnight. We're going to look at some really inspiring verses that hopefully will give you plenty of confidence so we can go out the next day, we can go out into school or into work and just be filled with some awesome confidence to take that forward. So roughly, as I mentioned before, we're going to be looking primarily at chapters 3 to 5 over the couple of fortnights, broken down roughly halfway through the middle, just to make it easier for myself. So tonight we'll begin with sort of a bit of background into Micah. I think that's always important just to get a bit of a feel as to where we are. And then we'll sort of dive into 3 and then the first part of 4 as well and really pick out some points. Ooh, got to turn this on. So what we're going to start with is, I guess, some primary school questions, just some general comprehension. We're going to look at the 5 W's. Because I think that gives a very easy overall look at what's going on with the background to Micah. I'll try and not get caught up in the history of it all. I love history. If Ted's happening to listen, he would love it, as perhaps a couple of others, but other people might fall asleep. So I'll try and get through it relatively quickly. I don't want to bore people too much. So who? It's kind of an obvious one. Micah is the author, but who is Micah? I could pick out 3 important points, and I'll ask you guys, what are some of the important points we get out as to who Micah is that we get from not this chapter, but maybe the first chapter?
He was a
Yes, that's not one of the points up here, but it's a slide. It's a slide later. It gets its whole slide. Any other? Yes. That's one.
Who is like unto Yahweh?
Yeah, and definitely goes against with what some of the other prophets at that time were that we speak about in Micah 3. I think that's really important. Three kings, yep. Very, very well pointed out. Barger bosses. So it's 3 kings. And then the other one, which is maybe a little bit ambiguous, but there's no family mentioned. It's just sort of just Micah.
You're supposed to be a shepherd at some time.
Possibly. You put me on the spot here. I didn't expect to get curly questions. Thought I'd missed something massive there. I haven't. Good. We got the 3 points there. So he's from Morisheth. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but that's fine. So that's roughly about 35 kilometres southwest of Jerusalem. So it's a fair distance, especially when they didn't have cars or anything like that. So just try and remember 35 kilometres. We'll bring out that in a second. He prophesied to three kings. We'll talk about that in a little bit, one of those other points, and we'll sort of get maybe a bit of a timeline going on. And then there's no family or father mentioned. He's not the only prophet that doesn't have this, but it certainly goes against, say, Isaiah, a couple of other prophets that specifically mention who their father was, maybe brings out a bit of the lineage. So what is this book about? Basically, it's a localized prophecy. So it's a prophecy made, and we can read that here at the end of verse 1 of Micah 1, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem, or Israel, and Judah, because obviously they were the capitals at the time. So it's not necessarily talking about other nations. There's no prophecies against, say, Assyria or Babylon. They're mentioned, but not specifically against them. I combined the next two just because that makes sense, and I didn't want to cut one of the W's out because otherwise it's four W's and it doesn't have a great ring to it. So I've got roughly there a bit of a timeline. Some of the dates might be a little bit hazy, just based on we don't know exactly when they reigned, but that was sort of the general consensus that I got. So it's about 50 odd years. I'm going to guess he probably started later on in the reign of Jotham, just because 50 years is a long time to be doing something. That's roughly the sort of time period we're looking at around 700 BC. And why did he do it? So I could see two main points as to why Micah was doing this, why God called Micah out to deliver these prophecies. And it really boiled down, as I said, to two points that are on the screen. It's informing the people of Jerusalem what's going to happen, that impending destruction that's going to come on them. And then also reassuring believers that, yes, there's going to be destruction that's coming, but God hasn't forsaken those who truly believe. And that there's a future as bright as light that's ready for them later on down the track. Micah obviously probably wasn't expecting the whole nation to turn around and suddenly start following after God, but he still delivers that message. He still gives that message of hope, even if there's not many believers. And I think that's really powerful for us anyway, reading it a whole lot longer in the future after. So James mentioned about the contemporary with Isaiah and Micah, so I thought I might just briefly look into that a little bit. Just look at some similarities and differences because I think it's interesting. So we'll look at the differences first. So first of all, I've got is sort of their location within Judah. We can't say for certain whether Micah just sort of stayed in his country town or whether he moved around. But we know Isaiah was sort of in Jerusalem. We can read through that. He was sort of in Jerusalem. We'll get to that in a little bit as well. Whereas Micah, I'm going to put forward, he was probably more of a country guy, living in the country, which are two vastly different circumstances. So if you remember before, I said that his town's about 35 kilometres away. And then I did a little bit of Google mapping and thought that's sort of similar to, say, Isaiah living in Sydney and Micah's living, say, in Wagga Wagga. Kind of two vastly different areas. You can get to them relatively easy, perhaps, but you don't have sort of a keen idea of what's going on. If you're in Wagga Wagga, you don't know what is necessarily happening in Sydney to a great degree, which I think comes out a fair bit in this chapter. Micah sort of goes over a couple of things, whereas Isaiah delves really into some of the meat of what's happening, perhaps in the courts. And then, as I mentioned, so you got that initial audience as well. Isaiah was hanging around kings. He would have been in with the upper class of society, around the courts. He would have had nobles, diplomats that he would have been able to speak to try and prophesy to and perhaps try and convert. Perhaps if we're using that Sydney and Wagga Wagga thing, he's speaking to the bigwigs of the country. Micah, on the other hand, if he is more in that country, he's speaking to more of the commoners, more of the farmers, people who are tradesmen, the everyday Jew at that time. So two vastly different areas. Obviously, both of their messages went throughout all of the land, but those initial recipients, I believe, would have been vastly different. And yet, despite those differences, which I guess ordinarily would alienate people from each other, we have some incredible similarities, and I think they're really amazing to look at. They both talk about the deliverance from Assyria, which at that time was one of the greatest superpowers of the world, and would have been really powerful because you've got those in Judah would have been able to look north and see Assyria's come through. They've wiped out Israel. Israel's gone. And then Assyria starts coming further south, starts coming into Judah, and you start thinking, oh no, is the same thing going to happen to me? Are we going to get taken away by the Assyrians? So we have here, no, you're going to be saved from Assyria. They both talk about that captivity into Babylon, though. And Babylon at that stage wasn't a superpower. It was still subordinate. And yet they both said, hey, you're going to go away to this faraway country that isn't really powerful right now. So that's an incredible prophecy. And then based on that, they're going to return back to the land. They're not going to stay in Babylon forever. They would have seen their fellow countrymen, I guess, in Israel. They left. They never came back. Those in Judah, they're going to leave. Some of them are going to come back, which I think is really amazing. So that's just a very, very brief look at a comparison between those. I think it's absolutely incredible that they were both able to prophesy at the same sort of time, and we have those similarities and those differences that come out. So before we jump into our sort of discussion, we're going to just very briefly look at what's going on here within this specific book. Generally, most people say it's broken up into three sections. I agree, but I think there's two major themes that come out. I think those major themes, I don't have them on the screen, but that's of judgment and then that coming glory with it being the kingdom of God. And to me, and we'll talk a bit more about this when I'm looking at Micah 3, I see them as being, I guess, two sides of a coin. They're both different, but they're also kind of connected a little bit. So we have those three breakdowns just on the screen. So as I mentioned, we're going to primarily focus on that highlighted section, which is the coming kingdom of God. First couple of chapters spoken mainly about the judgment on Jerusalem. Goes into quite a bit of detail with what's going to happen there, and some graphic language used as well. And then that third section I've just put as imperfection now and perfection later, because it still talks a lot about that judgment. And then later on in chapter 7, it talks about, you know, that forgiveness and the hope that we have, that despite all of the hopelessness around, we still have that amazing hope. So that's just roughly why I've put that there. Awesome. So let's dive into Micah 5. I'm basically going to roughly go through, I guess, section by section. It's not necessarily going to be going into the verses, but we'll be able to get some points out as to what's going on. And I guess for something that's supposed to be positive, you know, you hear the title, Micah's Kingdom Prophecies, why on earth would we start with Micah 3 and some of the graphic details that are talked about here? That's not what's going to happen in the kingdom at all. I wanted to start here primarily because it does mention here, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel. So I see it as that new section. And again, I see it as being critical to, I guess, understand what happens later on and see the drastic change for what happens. So we see who it's speaking to. It's speaking to the heads and the rulers. That's those that are in charge. These are people who should have been doing the right thing. They should have been that fair discerner between right and wrong, good and evil, and yet they're doing the complete opposite. They're hating good and loving evil. So this verse is effectively repeated later on in verse 9. We'll get there in a bit. I don't want to spoil what I talk about there. I also think that we have a bit of an echo to today. So non-believers out there tend to say that the Bible is, is old, doesn't have really any relevance to today. But I see this little verse here as being super accurate even today, as being something that happens all too often. How many times do we hear of some sort of corruption that happens where someone gives a bribe, for instance? Perhaps it's the wealthy getting away with some injustice that they've done simply by just getting away with it because they're wealthy or famous or whatever it happens to be. It reminds me, and this is just one example that immediately popped into my head just because, it interests me, with the global financial crisis. So that was caused by astronomical greed from a whole heap of banks. But only one executive went to prison. You would have thought something like that. Plenty of people would have been going to prison, losing their jobs. Some did lose their jobs, but only one went to prison. He lied and said that what he did was in the roughly around hundreds of millions that he'd lost, and then lied about and said that he hadn't lost. Within his particular bank, there were people who were lying up to a couple of $1 billion. There were other banks that were doing roughly similar sort of things. And this guy ended up going to prison. The judge himself, and this is a quote from the judge, said that the conduct was a small piece of an overall evil climate within the bank and with many other banks. And yet nothing else happened to them. So here's this judge saying, hey, I respect that what's going on here. You're a small cog. Plenty of other evil things are happening. And yet nothing else happens to those other people. This guy ends up going away for a few months and nothing else happens. That to me is someone in power who's not using their power correctly, who's looking at it and hating the good and loving the evil. Not only are they favouring evil over good, but they're kind of barbaric with their dealings as well. I'm hoping at least that the next couple of verses are more metaphorical and not literal. But how graphic is that? And this is what the rulers were basically doing. This is what their behaviour was leading to. Who tear the skin from off my people and their flesh from off their bones. Who eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin from off them and break their bones into pieces and chop them up like meat in a pot, like flesh in a cauldron. That's pretty graphic. Instead of being the shepherd to the people, instead of leading the people, trying to have them do right and protecting them, they're carving them up. They're acting the complete opposite, much like a butcher does there. The language here, as I've said before, is graphic, but in its own weird kind of way, it's perfect. It's perfect because that's exactly what their actions were having. And then in some sort of poetic justice, I guess, these rulers who have been ignoring the people, doing whatever they want to do, destroying them, devoting themselves to evil, will be ignored by God when destruction comes for them. Proverbs 1, we won't turn up the Proverbs 1, we'll turn up the Deuteronomy 1, we'll get there in a sec. Proverbs 1 speaks to similar ideas. If you turn away from God and you ignore him, then God's going to ignore you when bad times come. Obviously, we've got repentance that comes into it, but if you're ignoring God, God's not just going to help you if you get into some bad times, if you're not following along with God. So we'll just have a bit of a look at the Deuteronomy 1 quickly. You haven't drunk from this drink, have you, Ralph? You haven't drunk from this drink?
Nope.
No? Cool. We'll go for it. Always got to be certain these days. All right, so Deuteronomy 31, just those three couple of verses there. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers. Then these people will rise and whore after the foreign gods among them in the land that they are entering. And they will forsake me and break my covenant that I have made with them. Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day. And I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be devoured. And many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, 'Have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us?' And I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil that they have done, because they have turned to other gods." I think that wraps up basically that section very nicely. And I'm sure that Micah's mind would have been, when he's talking about this, would have been right here. Israel, throughout their history, have been ignoring God. It's happened time and time again, and it's going to happen again, unfortunately. So he moves on and basically continues this attack. He picks on another group of people, though. He picks on those that are the prophets. Again, these people are doing exactly the opposite to what they're supposed to be doing. I looked at it and thought, it's kind of like if I wanted to order a pair of shorts and I end up getting a jumper. It's completely the opposite thing for what I want. And that's what's going on here. They're doing completely the opposite kind of thing. It says there, "Who cry peace when they have something to eat, but declare war against him who puts nothing in their mouths." Essentially, what Micah is doing here is he's condemning them of picking and choosing based on what they receive rather than laying out God's plan or God's will. It reminds me again of perhaps movies set in medieval times. And you have this bad guy that wants to do something, perhaps it's a bit evil. And he'll stir the people up and he'll say, "God wills it. This is what God wants you to do. Let's go do it because I'm, you know, a prophet. I'm going to say we do this sort of thing," or a priest. And they'll end up doing it. They'll do some terrible things because this guy is saying, "Hey, God wills it." I see a similar thing here. These prophets here would have been saying, "Yeah, let's do something because God wills it." Inside, he's saying, "Yeah, let's do something because I want to, because I'm going to get something out of it. It's got here something to eat. I'm going to get money." It's what we'll talk about a little bit later. And if you don't do what happens, effectively, you're going to have war declared against you. You're not going to be able to get what you want. Things aren't going to go your way. I think that's just absolutely terrible. And God denounces this and declares that he's going to withdraw from them as well. Similar sort of language, that he's going to put them in darkness and not answer their pleas, just as we saw earlier. Terrible as well, given that they're supposed to be servants of God. They're supposed to be people, I guess, who should know better. And yet they're doing these terrible things. So we got there, the peace, and you're going to have something to eat. War, if you put nothing in their mouths. But then verse 8 has this great four little words. They're four tiny little words, but they're so powerful. "But as for me," Micah here is saying that he's just a commoner in a small little town. He's going to be the one to declare what God has to say. Micah has the true power of God. Micah has the Spirit of the Lord with him, unlike these other prophets. As such, his words should be held with the highest regard, and they would have been amongst their believers. And looking at it, I guess, the opposite way, totally disregard what the other prophets are saying. Micah's of God, the others are not. Micah then, and we're just down in verse 9, he hits back at the rulers again, goes in for round 2. They're perhaps thinking, okay, nothing else can be said about me. Micah goes back again. Again, he makes it clear that these rulers are not following justice. It's, you know, we should be paying attention to that. Both times he's talked about the rulers, both times he's mentioned of their injustice that they have. "They make crooked that which is straight," as the ESV puts it. These rulers weren't afraid to get dirty, potentially maybe even murdering their way to get to the top. Anything to have them raise that ladder and to get more power, more wealth, more personal glory. Which then, of course, leads to moneyitis. The chasing after money, doing everything, doing anything, just so you can get some more money. No longer is a judge determining the case based on facts. It's going to be based on the bribe. It says that in verse 11, its heads give judgment for a bribe. If we continue on, its priests teach for a price. Its prophets practice divination for money. Priests are only going to teach the Bible to you if you're willing to give them a little bit of money. Prophets are only going to tell the future if you're going to put some coin in their pocket first. Absolutely terrible things that are happening. And when you look at it, isn't that something that again happens nowadays? Maybe not in Australia, we tend to have fairly strict laws on say bribery and corruption, but you go into other places, I've seen this firsthand, get pulled over by the cop, pull out your wallet, offer him a little bit of money, hope it's enough. If it's enough, you're free to go. If not, you end up with a fine and the cop takes the money anyway. That's how you get out of trouble. Fortune tellers do this as well. They can have you can have your future predicted based on cards, based on a crystal ball, looking at your palm, whatever they do these days. But you're not going to get your answer until you've swiped your card. They're not going to do it for free, just as what these prophets and what these rulers were doing. They weren't doing it for free. They were doing it just to get rich. But even if you don't look at these things specifically, these couple of examples, money unfortunately still drives people and is going to continue to drive people to do things until Christ returns. So what's going to happen based on all of this sin that's mentioned throughout this entire chapter? It mentions there in verse 12, therefore, because of you, Zion shall be ploughed as a field, Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. Effectively, I've got there on the screen, it's going to be a proud city that's going to be brought to nothing. In a few short years, this thriving city is going to be just a heap of ruins. No one's going to live there. It's going to be full of sheep and goats. Bits and pieces of this were fulfilled by the Babylonians. So they went through, they destroyed the walls. We read they destroyed the temple, set fire to everything. That's bringing it to utter destruction. Later on, the Romans came through. They utterly destroyed the city as well. They ploughed it as a field. They went through and absolutely destroyed it. Second of Chronicles, we'll read this one because it goes into a lot of detail, I think. Second of Chronicles 36. And shows almost how accurate what's been said about here in the prophecy is. So from verse 17, then he, that's God, brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or aged. He gave them all into his hand, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all its palaces with fire and destroyed all its precious vessels. He took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia. So again, drawing in with some of those points that they're speaking about how you're going to eventually return, but look at some of those images there. Burned with fire, broke down the walls. This place was an absolute heap, just rubble, stones all on each other. And then as Micah mentions as well, the wooded height. And in my mind, I'm seeing that as just shrubbery, shrubs everywhere. Overgrowth has come up. all over the mountain. You can't really discern what's going on. Effectively, no one lives there anymore. It's gone back to how it should have been. This is what happens when sin comes into your lives. It happened physically then. It gave them that false sense of security, as we would have read in verse 11 of Micah. And then all of a sudden, it ends, and you're brought to a heap. I'm sure these priests and these rulers, they didn't set out wanting to take a bribe or to offer money for things, but it would have happened the first time. And then slowly and surely, you know, happened the second time, then the third time. And before you knew it, it just became the new norm. They woke up before they taught. They went out and got some money from the people. We need to look at ourselves. We need to remove anything within us that has become a norm, those sinful things that have become a norm, because that's going to bring us to destruction eventually and bring us as a heap. So that's sort of some of the negative stuff. But it builds up on that. It goes the complete 180. And we now move into some of those really uplifting ideas, especially for someone reading this, you know, 2,500 years after it's written. Yes, we can get lessons from chapter 3, but chapter 3, we don't physically ourselves have, you know, Babylonians marching down into Adelaide who are physically going to be attacking us. Chapter 4 is what's literally right around the corner. We're almost close enough to basically reach out and touch it. And it is really uplifting. So just one thing to note, if you were aware, you perhaps were, Isaiah 2. Isaiah 2, the first five verses, are basically, it's almost word for word, the exact same. And me being me, just wanted to do research to see who said it first. So I thought I would just roughly share. Basically, no one knows who said it first. It's a little anticlimactic. There was some suggestion perhaps that it was Micah that said it first, just based on you've got the end of chapter 3 talking about the house of mountain of the house, beginning of chapter 4 talks about the mountain of the house. So there is some context that sort of lines up, whereas Isaiah basically is just sort of there. So that is perhaps one idea that's why I guess lean to. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. God would have instructed both of these prophets to add this in. We know that everything in the Bible is written because he wants it to be written. People aren't writing on a whim. But I thought it was just kind of curious and interesting to see who wrote it first. So we can move on from that. So it starts off, "It shall come to pass in the latter days," which immediately tells me two things. First one is shall, and that is sort of definitive language. I love looking at this where it mentions shall, will, all of these kind of things. It's not ambiguous. Micah didn't write, you know, it may come to pass. He wrote that it shall come to pass. It's written in stone. This thing's 100% going to happen. And then the latter days, we get from other prophecies, that basically means where we are now. We're in the latter days. So when we're reading this, it should give us that hope. Whenever we read latter days, hey, this is, you know, this is where we are. Things could be happening, you know, on our way home tonight, perhaps, or later this week, maybe next week. This is where we're living. This is the time that we're living. So what's going to definitely happen in these latter days? What shall happen? Well, the temple's going to be reestablished. It's not just going to be on any mountain. It's going to be on the highest of the mountains, over the hills. We know from other prophecies that there's going to be that mountain. But even if we look at it on a symbolic level, it tells us of a lot. You know, if you look at ancient religions, say the Greek gods, the Greek gods didn't live in the valley of Olympus. It was Mount Olympus. It was something you looked to. If you wanted to build a palace, you didn't build it in a valley or sort of on the flatland. You built it on a hill. You built it so people could see, so people could admire it. Even if we look at Jerusalem, Jerusalem Mount, that had the temples. It's now got a mosque there. This is where people build things. But here, it's not just any old mountain. It's the highest of the highest. And that to me just shows how superior God is over everything. God's right at the top, and everyone else is down further. And not only that, but people are going to flow to this place. Not many people nowadays flow towards anything religious, I guess. But people here are going to be flowing to it. If we look at Jeremiah 51, and I think this will be the last verse that we'll look up. Jeremiah 51 is absolutely amazing with just its wording that it uses specifically here. So Jeremiah 51 and verse 44. And I will punish Bel in Babylon and take out of his mouth what he has swallowed. The nations shall no longer flow to him. The wall of Babylon has fallen. So Bel there, Bel means Lord. That was the chief god of the Babylonian religion, kind of like Zeus of the Greeks, I guess. Like many other nations, the Babylonians attributed success in battles, success in overcoming various challenges to their gods helping them. And we saw in Micah chapter 3, God turned his back on those who ignored him, and here he's going to remove the power that those gods have. Obviously, they don't have real power, but that symbolic power that they have to the people, just when the Babylonians need it the most. But then what's going to happen after that God punishes Bel? The nations shall no longer flow to him. They're no longer going to flow towards sinful things. Where are they going to flow to? They're going to flow to God. They're going to flow to his temple and to in that coming kingdom. So then in verse 3 to 5 of Micah, we get some really awesome pictures of what life's going to be like in the kingdom. Other sections, for those who listened to John's talk, he talked about Psalm 72. That's really amazing. That goes into perhaps a little bit more detail. Here we've got what I think are 7 key sort of distinct things that we get just from these 3 verses, which I think are absolutely amazing. We're going to go through them in a second. We're not going to go into huge amounts of detail. I think most of them speak for themselves. But what we are going to do, we can see there we've got that comparison of whether it happens now and whether it's going to happen in the kingdom. And we're going to see, you'll see anyway. We'll see what happens. So the first one is that there's going to be judgment between many peoples. And I've added up there that there's going to be fair judgment because, as we've seen in the previous chapter, not all judgment is fair. There's going to be fair judgment in the kingdom. Is that something that we see now? No, absolutely not. We've already looked at a couple of examples. We don't have to look far to see the injustice that people are shown based on skin color, based on religion, where they were born, perhaps if they have a disability, all sorts of things. All characteristics that a person can't help or doesn't have any control over. But in the kingdom, that's not going to matter at all. Because we're going to have a judge that's going to look deeper than the skin, deeper than what they can see, and is going to look into our hearts. I think that's absolutely amazing. So doesn't happen now, definitely doesn't. In the kingdom, it is. We're going to have disputes settled between strong nations. Does that happen now? To a degree, I guess, thanks to the UN, but I'm still going to lean with no, because with the strong nations, they do whatever they want anyway. No one's going to be able to tell them what to do. Recently, there's been a trade war between China and the US. Australia's been caught up in it. Plenty of other countries have been caught up in it. There's been no successful mediation from the UN or any sort of world organization. They haven't been able to go in and sort out either of the leaders and say, cut it out. They're just left to their own devices, left to do whatever they want to do. In the kingdom, though, it's going to be a success. You are going to be able to talk between these strong nations and settle those disputes. So we're perhaps already seeing a bit of a pattern emerge. We've got that famous verse that talks about the weaponry is basically going to be turned into farm tools. Now, I looked... Oh, sorry, I won't jump to that point yet. Obviously, the weapons listed that they're outdated, that doesn't really matter. It's still easy enough to melt down guns, equipment, all sorts of things. Reuse it into whatever else needs to be used, in, say, around the farm. So hopefully you can see that. I tried to make it as big as I could. That's the amount of spending that happened last year and even shows 2018 as well. That's per year how much billions of dollars those countries spend just on their military. So the first box that I've got highlighted right there is the amount that they spent in billions. And this here is their total GDP of what that country makes in a year and how much of a percentage that goes just to the military. So for those who are perhaps struggling to see, right at the top, we have the US, who spent $732 billion on the military last year. That's amazing. Not amazing in a good way, amazing in a terrible way. That's 3.4% of their total GDP that they make is going straight into the military. Just think about some of the things that they could achieve with that money if they stopped, even for a year, stop spending that amount of money. You know, they could fix up schooling, they could fix up roads, hospitals, they could feed and clothe those who are disadvantaged, and yet they're not. They're pumping it all towards here. So there's some staggering numbers there. That's all going to stop, though. That's all going to stop. We're no longer going to be pumping money into building these weapons. And as we move on, there's just going to be no more war. So you still can have war without weaponry. People will figure out a way to punch people, do whatever. But there's going to be just no war, flat out no war, which is amazing. And if we take it to that next step, we're not even going to learn about it anymore. We're not even going to discuss it. Places like West Point, Duntroon, they're not going to exist anymore because there's going to be no need. We don't need to learn about the totally barbaric form of just fighting against everyone. So what are people going to do? Obviously, people aren't all the time thinking about war, but what are people going to do? They're going to be sitting peacefully at home. Is that something that happens nowadays? Generally not. Even in a country like Australia, we don't always sit peacefully at home. Things happen. I sort of get the mental image here because it speaks about, you know, you're under the vine, under the fig tree. I get this mental image that I've got my feet up underneath the shade of a tree, looking up, sort of seeing the birds fly in the sky, looking at it, how spectacular God's kingdom, God's creation is. That's the kind of thing we're going to be able to do. We're just going to be sitting peacefully at home. We're not going to be waging war. We're not going to be doing anything terrible. And then the last one to me is the absolute best one. There's going to be no more fear. No more fear of any kind. Even here in Australia, as I said, we're relatively safe. There's still fear. I don't walk around the streets I don't walk anyway, but I don't walk around the streets at night time because roughly where I live, it's not great. I don't want to get beaten up or anything. That's fear. We're no longer going to have that. Again, I sort of get that mental image, and you see all of the camps that people have of all the Syrian refugees who are just minding their own business and then all of a sudden just get bombed. Just for absolutely no reason at all. They have fear every day of their lives. And yet there's eventually going to be a day, we hope it's going to be soon, when there's just going to be no more fear at all. That to me is absolutely amazing. And then verse 5 wraps up this little bit. I guess it summarizes what we've got on the screen with those X's under the now column and the ticks under the kingdom. It says, for all the peoples walk each in the name of its God, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Again, that's kind of a mind-blowing idea, the thought of living forever, the thought of never dying, when we have death and mortality all around us. And I know I'm definitely not alone when I say I truly can't wait for that day. When we wake up, we're feeling perfectly fine. There's no more death. Revelation sort of continues that, says that there's going to be no more sorrow as well. We can continue that thought there. That's just absolutely amazing. My words aren't going to describe, even the words here aren't going to describe what this is going to be like when we eventually get to live it. So that's basically it. It's been a bit of a roller coaster. We sort of started with the condemnation of the leaders, those who are in charge, and we've come through to this amazing five verses that show us what a wonderful, show us a vivid sight into what the kingdom's going to be like. But what's this mean all for us? Well, I see sort of three major points. It provides examples for us of what not to do. Basically, that entire third chapter gives us ideas of things that we shouldn't be doing. Some of you may have heard the quote, comes from Spider-Man, "With great power comes great responsibility." Those people had great power. They didn't have great responsibility. So we need to be careful when, if we happen to be in a position of power, we need to be using it wisely. Even if we're not, we're still going to have some sort of power or position of power over someone. We need to be using it in the right sort of ways, using it towards God's glory and not towards our own glory. We've seen the consequences of sin in quite a graphic way. I said before, it's clearly metaphorical for us because we're not physically under attack. But we need to be constantly on our guard, because otherwise we will end up like a ruined heap if we continue to let sin come into our lives. We need to keep our bodies pure as we can, pure like a temple that Paul speaks about over and over again in his letters. And then we've seen that the victory far outweighs the present day power and wealth that can happen. All of those things that we went through, all of those positive ticks, I would take all of those in a heartbeat, because they're so much amazing than just that physical power or wealth. Paul speaks of something similar in Romans 8. He says that the sufferings of this present time aren't worth comparing to the glory that is to be revealed to us. And if we substitute the word power, say, instead of sufferings or money, nothing is going to compare to what that future holds for us in God's kingdom. So that's roughly what I wanted to speak about. So we're going to just wrap up our discussion here. Next fortnight, as Raph mentioned, we're going to be talking, God willing, about the rest of chapter 4 and into chapter 5. It's just going to get better and better as we continue to go along.